This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
I'd like now to welcome Isabel onto the stage. Isabel, who's a colleague of mine at Cambridge International Exams, she's a senior education advisor for us. She's had a career in public service in the UK for many years, including civil service posts in several government departments and senior roles in regulation in medicine and in education. After 4 years as Deputy Health Service Commissioner, the Ombudsman, she joined the General Medical Council in 1999 at a time of significant regulatory reform. So we can see how the experience is building up. Subsequently, she set up two new national organisations, one covering the regulation of health professionals and the other overseeing postgraduate medical education. In 2005, she became a director at the Qualification and Curriculum Authority, from which she moved to lead the establishment of Ofqual as an independent regulator of qualifications, first in its interim form within QCA from 2008, and then as an independent statutory regulator from 2010. She joined us in March 2011, and she's now based in our new Asia-Pacific office in Singapore. Her role there is to advise Cambridge on developments in educational policy and thinking in the Asia-Pacific region, which is a fast-growing and important region educationally, and to contribute to international discussion and debate, particularly on curriculum and assessment. Thank you.
I'm going to move on a little bit from what Mick has been talking about to talk about national tests and national examinations and delivery risk in those. I'm going to say something more about my lessons from 2008, but not just about that, to try and broaden it a bit. I'll first of all define my own terms and then say what delivery failures are, and I've got some examples to discuss. And then, in the spirit of this morning, I thought I'd take some examples from medicine, some concepts there that are used to regulate medicine and to think about healthcare, and see if those can help us to think about exams and tests. Now, first of all, about terms, national tests and examinations. What I mean by national tests is tests taken by whole cohorts of students at particular points in the national curriculum, like the national curriculum test that Mick was talking about. I'm not, in this presentation, talking about, for example, sample tests or the international PISA or TIMSS tests. Those are different types of tests for another day. So it's these whole cohort tests, like the tests in 2008, which Mick was talking about. And as far as national examinations are concerned, I think we all know what we mean. We mean examinations which are normally largely externally marked or moderated, which are prescribed by national governments or state governments to be taken at certain points, usually at the end of secondary education or at a particularly important point there. So the obvious ones for us are GCSEs and A-levels and the like. So that's what I mean by national tests and examination. And by delivery failure, what I mean is a failure to deliver results of tests or national examinations on time or free from avoidable mistakes. And this is about delivery in the way that Mick was talking about. What I don't mean today, although it's really important and interesting, is what some of you know as marking error, which is a technical term about unreliability, which all assessments have and some more than others, etc., etc. And I'm not talking directly about controversies about the way that tests or exams are marked or the way that they're graded. Although one of the events in the past, the A-level problems in 2002, had a mixture of elements, some of them about delivery, some of them about grading and assessment controversy. Of course, all of those things are really important, but I'm particularly talking about delivery. Now, in the handout that you have, if you skip the slides and look at page 10, what you'll find there is a selective list, it's not comprehensive, of examples of delivery failure in national tests and examinations in England in the UK since 2000, starting with the severe problems with the hires in Scotland in 2000, which was one of the most serious of the lot. There's examinations there and tests, and also the earlier problems with tests before 2008, and going right up and including some of the problems in summer 2011. I've put the 2002 A-levels in square brackets because they're not wholly about delivery, but there's other issues there as well. I haven't included issues about this summer. This was written before that, but also because those are largely some of the debates have been about grading and about the approach used rather than the actual delivery issues, which I'm going to concentrate on. But I think that some of the lessons that we're going to talk about are more widely applicable. Now, what about me? Where do I come from? Now, like Mick, neither of us are throwing stones from the outside in all of this. It's very important. We're trying to share lessons from experience from being in the inside of there. I was there in 2008 when all this happened. I was a member of the QCA executive earlier that awarded the contract to ETS. I was the head of Ofqual when we were coping with this in the early months of the organisation. I was the person who advised that an independent inquiry should be set up. And some of the criticisms that Lord Sutherland made, which you heard about from Mick, were about Ofqual and reflected decisions that I made or was involved in. So I was there. And so these are reflections, perhaps with the help of geographical distance, on what happened and what we can learn from it. My bottom line for this is not the interests of any organisation, whether it's the government or Ofqual or an awarding body, but the public good. And I mean by that not just the short-term interest of candidates, but their longer-term interests of their families and of society in having a robust and respected system of qualifications. And one of the themes that's underlying today's conference is that at risk and what can we do about it? So I'm talking about the public good, quite unashamedly. And my question is, how can we minimise risk to the public good from delivery failures in national tests and examinations? Now, you've heard the quote from Ken Boston about vans and all the rest of it. And what's different about delivering national tests and examinations compared, for example, to delivering milk or something else like that? Now, some elements are common because cartons of milk go around the country in vans, and there's also quite a lot of the lessons in the Sutherland report are very similar to what you see in business schools and other courses about manufacturing and delivery. But there's particular things about exams and tests. The importance of the outcomes for candidates' life chances about their next educational stage or about whether they go to university, which one, and what they do next. And even where that is less, as in the case of the tests, the investment of emotion and occasion and significance for candidates and for schools and teachers in these tests or the examinations that are being taken are a particular thing. There's a flag flying. In Korea, there are literally flags flying when the tests and exams are set. But even here, in our understated way, there's a metaphorical flag flying there. And those are really important life events. And that gives them a particular sense of importance compared to the cartons of milk. Also, in the processes we're talking about, and Simon Liebes mentioned this, there's an irremovable element of judgment involved in some of the processes. It's not just taking the milk and putting it from one place to the next. However much you're a statistician person or a judgmental person, there's an element of judgment. And in the tests, that's particularly so with English, which irretrievably has an element of judgment, which always causes complications and difficulties in the processes. So all of those are elements that make exams and tests a bit different. Not unique, but a bit different. There's also the context, and you've heard quite a lot about that this morning, what I've called edu political controversy. Now, my view is that education is rightly at the heart of politics. It is wrong to try and throw politicians out of education because it's important, and politics should be about the things that are most important. However, the constant mishmash of controversy and debate and the lack of a consensus about the way forward makes progress very difficult, it makes modernisation difficult for the reasons you've heard, and it makes innovation difficult, because most processes that are going to be successful in this area take about 10 to 15 years to introduce, and the normal life cycle for a government is much less than that, or a parliament is much less than that. So you have this tension. So somehow you've got to manage risk in a place where there is this background of political controversy and also edu-political. You have academics in camps associated with particular points of view, often rather polarised, artificially polarised camps, and that makes life very difficult. So you have this big process. You have 9 million scripts going around in vans. You have all the controversy, and things are almost inevitably going to go wrong. Now, in 2008, at the time that the tests are being delivered, we had some emails from schools about what they expected and what they thought they had a right to expect. And it's broadly that. They expected the test results to be delivered on time, to know which result was for which student, to accurately record the marks that the marker had given, and in time to be issued to the kids before they went on holiday. Now, that seems to me a pretty reasonable thing to expect. And that's just a basic bedrock of what you might expect in terms of standard of service. And as Mick has said, that wish was shared by all teachers and schools, even teachers who thought the tests should be abolished. Given that they'd put all that effort into them, they wanted to get the results so that they could use them. The tolerance of delivery failure in national exams and tests is very, very low. I think that people from ETS who came to work in this were very, very surprised, even compared with the highly volatile educational atmosphere in the United States. They were very, very surprised at the enormous hoo-ha there was in this country about quite small delays as they saw it. The tolerance of delay of anything other than the absolute standard delivery is almost zero. And in an industry with 9 million scripts going around in vans, something's going to go wrong. So how on earth do you manage this? Now, one of the things I want to borrow from medicine for us to think of is a criterion for deciding whether an experience of a public service delivery is acceptable or not. This is for an individual episode. And one of the things I learnt from him, he was a very distinguished chief medical officer both in England and in Scotland, was his criterion for an individual episode of patient care, whether it was acceptable or not. And this was his criterion. And that's the one that he asked us to use. Now, these are my late mother and father. It's very nice to see them up there and see them joining us in the conference. The test was, he called it the My Mother test. And this was a very profound comment made in his characteristically light way. If what happened to that patient, that one patient, if I would be angry or feel it was unacceptable for it to happen to my mother, then it is not acceptable. And the public authorities need to say so loudly and clearly. It doesn't matter if 100 other patients were well treated. If my mother was badly treated, it is not acceptable. This doesn't mean that it's that everything has to be perfect. Of course, I want my mother to have the best possible care. But I found as an ombudsman that relatives were very tolerant of difficulties that doctors had and another crisis at the time. But, for example, if my mother had her food at the foot of the bed just outside her reach or was lying in soiled sheets, it is not acceptable. And the public authorities need to make that judgment clearly. Now, the point that Ken Carman was making was not about communications, just you've got to always say something about the patient first. It wasn't that. It was that's the judgment. That's a judgment you should make. And it's not difficult to convert that into my son, my daughter, when you get to the national tests and examinations. And in some of the tests and examinations I've listed on page 10 of the handout, there were in fact ministers who had sons or daughters involved, both in Scotland in 2000 and in England in 2002. And I don't think that distorted the minister's view. I think that informed it. So if you don't remember anything else I say, please remember the My Mother test, because it's a good one to stay with you. As a public servant, I think that's what we should be using. The other thing I wanted to borrow from medicine, and it will structure the rest of what I'm going to say, is the ideas of primary, secondary and tertiary prevention, which are very familiar to doctors and nurses. Primary prevention is really health promotion. It's trying to have a good, healthy system so that things don't go wrong in the first place. Secondary prevention is about when things begin to go wrong, trying to avoid them getting worse and serious disease taking place. And tertiary prevention is when it's all happened. The worst has happened, the disease has set in, you're trying to minimise its damage and bring about rehabilitation. It's these three stages. And I think it's quite helpful to apply these three stages to what we do. These are the quotations from the Department of Health's website. I think they were rather poetic when they said primary prevention was refocusing upstream to stop people falling in the waters of disease, but never mind. And the important thing to remember is you have to know about all three stages. The primary prevention is not, if you do that right, you still may have to do secondary and tertiary, because even fit people get diseases. That's, you have to be prepared for all of them. One is not an excuse for the others. So quickly, what kind of lessons could we learn about primary prevention in national exams and tests? This is for delivery issues. One that I've learned a little bit from my experience in the last couple of years is about the possible virtues of trying to bring together multi-partisan academic and political support for long-term discussions of changes. And this has been done very well in Australia, where very bravely, for the reasons that you've got from Mick, they've decided not only to mark their national curriculum tests online, but actually to get them taken online, which is an even bigger gulp for us in England. And they knew that that would be a problem for the reasons that we always knew in QCA, because it would be a discontinuity in the series of outcomes, and that would be very difficult to handle politically. But they got together, the government and the opposition parties and the academics, who, with all the different views of the NAPLAN tests, and got them to agree a consensus statement of what would happen and how that could be mitigated. And there's a way that they're doing double banking of series of results so that people can get some kind of series from the computerised results to compare with them, and facing the inescapable fact that there will not be a continuous pattern. Now, that's an example of some attempt to try to do something difficult in an edu-political controversial climate. I think it's to be welcomed. So maybe we could try and think of something there. Trying to avoid layer after layer of small changes, because they just get to the stage that there's just too much. And some of the Ofqual reports on the marking problems in 2011 have good examples of that. Things like changing the numbering system and the optical scanning system and everything else. Each one in its own is fine, but it just gets to the stage that it's just too much for people to handle. Then, again, you heard a little bit about this, a bit about this before from Mick. There are risks in regulating a monopoly. The National Curriculum Test was a classic regulated monopoly in assessment. There's the National Lottery, for example, is another one. And there are big issues there. As you've heard, it can be that a monopoly can end up that only a tiny number of organisations, or perhaps even one, have the expertise to provide the service. There's also, you can do this market stimulation, as you heard from Mick, but it carries a risk of bringing into the market organisations that don't really know the context in which they're working. And there can be big problems in controlling prices if the one organisation with all the expertise more or less has the hand on the lever. There are ways of mitigating those. It's not an argument against monopolies, but there are big primary prevention issues around regulating a monopoly. There's then the issue of process mapping and end-to-end process tracking that you've heard about from Mick. Now, there's good stuff in Sutherland about that, and also in some of the Ofqual reports on marking and question setting. One of them is about what they call ripple effects, about looking across the process you're planning and saying, if something went wrong there, would it have effects on other things? And which are the ones that have the biggest ripple effects? An obvious one being the recruitment of markers. If you're delayed in that, then it'll delay their training, it'll delay the allocation of scripts, it'll delay the quality assurance. The whole lot just goes down the line. And also finding gaps when it's just a task that you've got nobody doing. However, it can be a snare and a delusion. Process maps can become a sort of obsessional horror of their own. In the QCA, there was a process map of the delivery of the diploma. I'm looking at Tom here, I think may remember it. It took four walls of a room in the QCA. The only thing I could get that reminded me of what it looked like is this. And people were going around with stickers and, you know, page 4 and line 702, and what about this? Nobody stood back and said, this is a ludicrous way to deliver a qualification. It really does not make sense. No wonder the whole thing was too much for people to handle. And nobody did stand back. We got obsessed by the end-to-end process map. So there are dangers in that. But the idea of mapping out the process in a high-level way and looking for ripple effects is a good one. The same about risk registers, which you've heard about from Mick. The important thing is from the beginning to have a risk management system which enables the high-level risk questions to be asked. What are the risks of this contract not being delivered? What about it not being delivered on time, of the quality being unacceptable? And the ability to synthesise upwards from the mass of risks. You heard about the risk register that we had for the National Curriculum Tests, and I recall it with some horror of meetings that I would be, as Ofqual, would be sitting there saying, I'd like to talk about the risk register. And with a wounded look, the telephone directories were held up and people said, well, look, we're managing our risk. We've got 326 we're having 17 meetings next week. Why are you asking about all this detail? That's quite disproportionate for a regulator. And who was standing back and asking, what is the overall risk of this? And there's something about setting the system up in the wrong way. And I think I fully endorse what Mick said about that. Moving on to secondary prevention, that's when it's begun to go wrong. What lessons can we learn from that? I think for those of you who have not worked in the civil service at all, it's difficult for you to understand how, for those of us who have, almost everything is a near miss. And I mean this with the greatest respect. Everybody who works, I'm looking at my colleague here, you're nodding your head. Everything is done in a rush. It's not a political point at all. It's under-resourced. It's achieved at the last minute. And, oh, you know, you're writing amendments to bills in the middle of the night. Oh, this is just what the life is. That's what life in government is. And it can be quite stimulating in that way, if one's honest. But that is what it is. So it's very difficult for civil servants to differentiate between things that are just the normal panic and things that are really going to go wrong. It's no good if an executive agency comes up at the very beginning, the first thing that goes wrong, says, can't do it, sorry. When I was in the civil service, we called that delivering dead mice, because it was just no good at all. On the other hand, if they keep saying, oh, it'll be fine, don't worry at all, and then the day before the test results are due, that's no good either. And it's very, very difficult to judge that dividing line, and do not underestimate it. One way is to have regular summative review points where you make yourselves stand back and say, how is this going? What is the overall risk of it? And what is the risk of it going wrong? And then at some point in the secondary stage, not I think at the primary stage, but the secondary stage, saying, do we need to begin to consider a plan B here? One for the test results would have been to delay, once we realised it was going to take longer, to have a planned delay of the date of the announcement. It wouldn't have been welcomed, but it'd been better than the shambles that took place. And you could say that would have been a plan B, but it wasn't thought about early enough to have points where you say, should we be developing a plan B, and then a no-go decision date that's not too late in the process. Then there's the issue of the focus of your risk management. Now, those of you who have GCSE history will all know that the reason that Singapore fell in 1942 was because the British guns were pointing in the wrong direction. In fact, that's not quite right, because you could see that they could swivel round, but they were actually sighted in the wrong places to expect an invasion from the south, and it came from the north. Now, in Ofqual, we had decided at the beginning of the series leading up to the 2008 test that the biggest risk here, particularly Ofqual as a standards regulator, was the removal and the changes of a method of quality assurance of marking known as borderlining, which some of you will know about. The removal of borderlining could result in discontinuities of marks and unhappy schools, and we decided this was the risk. And our guns were set on borderlining, and that did not change. Other people were saying, oh, they might never be delivered at all. Borderlining, we said, and we stuck to it. And it was a bit like my forefathers in Singapore. There is a lesson there about reviewing. Are you sighting your guns in the right place? And not just making the decision at the beginning and sticking to it, whatever. You also heard a little bit about the language of risk escalation. And that was something that was rightly criticised by Lord Sutherland, really quite a lot in what he said. It's very common for organisations to use traffic lights of some sort, and certainly both QCA and in my time Ofqual did that, but they all meant slightly different things by them and got themselves all tangled up. There were different cultures about the use of red, and particularly whether it indicated priority concerns or some absolute level of risk. And there was a feeling in QCA that too many red risks reported to the board indicated weakness of management. You know, will they think that we can't manage the organisation if we have more than those? And this was the time when the diploma was being developed, when Ofqual was being relocated, when lots and lots, the whole QCF that you heard about from Simon was being introduced, lots of things of high risk, not just tests. And the tests, in fact, had settled a little bit since earlier times. So there was a feeling that there was a bit of a management, it was a bit of a sense of failure. You weren't there to hand on red risks, you were there to sort them out. A sort of business feeling about that. However, when I went to Ofqual and a new risk committee there, they, I think rightly, were very suspicious of pages of green everywhere and said, well, just a minute, is that really right? Have you reviewed that? And I think I applaud them. That was the right thing to do. And so there's a bit of a difference about what we're talking about here. And you all know about all of this stuff. But in my view, if you use these blessed traffic lights, they should be criterion referenced and not norm referenced. They're not the four most dangerous things. If there's 10 dangerous things in your organisation, you should be able to share that with your board. And the theology of traffic lights should not get in the way of the board and being able to challenge senior managers and say, never mind all that stuff. What's keeping you up at night? What is really a risk here? Tell us what you think as a senior manager. We got very tangled up with the way that risk management works, particularly at the QCA. Then, at the secondary stage, this is when things are beginning to go wrong, there's a really difficult issue of what attention the authorities involved and the regulators should pay to soft intelligence, as I've politely called it, gossip, about things going wrong. And that became quite frequent during the time building up to the 2008 test results, particularly grumbling markers. And we began to get little messages from them that the sessions, the training sessions, weren't going well, and they didn't know which one they were going to until 5 minutes before, and they didn't get the information they wanted, and it wasn't good, and there were people not turning up, and there wasn't a trainer, blah, blah, blah. And when we put this to the NAA as a regulator, there was a general resentment that we were just listening to gossip from chums, particularly when some of my team actually knew markers personally, that they were just listening to the phone and listening to gossip. And it's a difficult one, that. I mean, my view is that gossip is not the truth, however often it's repeated, but it should be permissible for open-ended questions to be asked, prompted by soft intelligence. It should be okay for the regulator or for the government to say, we have heard stories about this, what would you like to tell us about that? In an open mind, be willing to be told that there are a lot of nonsense and it's just that the markers didn't like ETS or whatever. But it should be all right to ask the question. And there was too much resentment of that and too much diffidence. The paradox then was that everybody knew, with hindsight, that this was going to go wrong, but it appeared that the government QCA and Ofqual didn't know until very last minute. Ofqual allegedly knew 1 week before everybody else, but that's not much when you're talking about a process of over a year building up. And you have the same story in the example that Mick gave of G4S, when the MPs said to the unhappy Mr. Buckles, but we've had messages from our constituents for months that this is going wrong. When did you know? Last Monday, he said. And they just didn't believe it. So there's a whole issue of how to cope with soft intelligence at the secondary stage. There's also the role of the board in all of this. And most of the organisations that deliver tests and exams have boards. And when they have that, it's important that the board is able to stand back and take a wide-angled view of the work of the organisation. And as a chief executive, that's one of the most important checks and balances, because if a management is focused, particularly on something else like the diploma at the time, which was very much occupying people's minds, or relocation, or whatever it is, your mind can go off the ball. And something like Ofqual, when we had general qualifications and we had tests, if one was sort of bubbling up politically, the temptation was to neglect the other one. And there need to be checks and balances for that. And the board has an important job in challenging management to do this. And if there isn't a board in the organisation, management has to build in its own checks and balances to achieve that. Now, moving on, lastly, to tertiary prevention. This is when it's happened. You've got the disease now. The deadline has been missed. What can you do to put it right? First of all, any public statements that are made must reflect the judgments in the My Mother test. It must, first of all, start by thinking what the effect of what has happened has is on candidates or schools and families. This is not just PR. This is actually should reflect the judgments made by the organisation. Any revised deadline set must be realistic and must be met. This was not done in 2000 in Scotland with the hires. They set an ambitious target for getting them done, and they didn't meet that one either. And what you find is when something has gone badly wrong, those affected become obsessional students of the detailed wording of what those involved say, and they'll bring it back to you. As an ombudsman, half the issues that I dealt with were about badly handled complaints because the hospitals or the health authorities just made untrue statements and they hadn't thought about it. It's better to set a longer deadline and to achieve it than not to achieve what you do. The other, which is a lesson I learnt from the government departments in the old DCSF, I think they may well still do it, was the practice of setting up what they called gold teams when something went badly wrong to put it right. And these were sort of crisis management teams, and there's quite a lot of status in having a period of serving in those. The QCA also put very good people into the recovery from the 2008 tests, and a really thankless task of trying to find these blessed scripts. And script by script, we had these tallies of numbers of scripts that had been found each day. And there was status and achievement in the work of these recovery teams, and I thought they did an outstanding job. And you have to, as the organisation, give them all the praise and status within, because people from outside are so annoyed they won't thank them. But the idea of putting a team of good people onto it is a good one. Then there's the question of whether one should set up an independent inquiry or not. Now, I advised my board at the time in Ofqual that we should commission an independent inquiry. There were some things that were particular at the time. Ofqual was part of QCA, so it was governance was too close to the organisation was closely involved, but also that some of the activities of Ofqual should be under scrutiny too. And we had to recognise that. It was the early days of the organisation. We had to send a message about how we were going to operate. But there are those who thought that was wrong, and who still, to this day, thought that was the wrong decision. And they will go cite in their defence the very good report that the QCA board did in 2004, and I've put that in my bibliography, the Beazley report, which was highly critical, but done within the board. And they said, why couldn't we do that again? Now, my view was that public confidence required an independent inquiry, but there's a matter of judgment there. And generally speaking, my lessons would be, if what you're asking is we need to find out accurately what happened and to how many people, then the organisation involved is probably in the best position to do it. But once that's happened, if it is, well, let's think now, reflect back, why did it happen and who is to blame, then a degree of independence may be needed. And that's the kind of principle that I would apply in the future. Then there's the attribution of blame. When the Ombudsman judges complaints, it's about what, not what the ideal thing to do would be, but they set up what they call a zone of reasonable behaviour, and they say, was what was done within that zone or was it outside it? Because you have to realise the practicalities of life at the time. And that's the kind of thing that you should have in mind when making attributions of blame. It's very, very important to watch the language in which blame and answers to blame are expressed. There's a super a historic paper by John Austin called A Plea for Excuses, which I've put in the bibliography. If you ever have a chance to read it, please do. It's wonderful on the vocabulary of blame and of apologies. And please don't say, I'm sorry if. I have to say that complainants to the Ombudsman were incensed when they got replies. I'm sorry if the treatment you received at our hospital was not pleasing to you when the person had died. It's not I'm sorry if, it's just a cop-out. It's I'm sorry that, and it's very important to avoid that. It may be necessary to state clearly that an outcome is unacceptable for the public service to do that, even if nobody can be said to be to blame. And we should expect and anticipate and work with blame-shifting behaviour, particularly in the political world. You will see I've put in the bibliography some articles by Christopher Hood, who's tried to trace that and to get some theorising around it. But you should remember that the public on the whole is completely unimpressed by that. One thing I learned as an ombudsman is we're all them. And they weren't interested whether it was the health authority or the hospital or whoever it was. It's all them and they have let me down. Those of you who know your Bible will know this one. And that is basically how people behave. So God said to the QCA, hast thou eaten of the tree? The QCA said, the ETS that thou gavest to be with me, that was the person that was at fault. And ETS said it was somebody else. And that is what tends to happen. But where I'm living now, things are different. If you're a policy watcher, a politics watcher in the UK, you wouldn't believe Question Time in Singapore, which consists of a minister standing up and making an announcement and one of the small number of opposition MPs saying thank you very much. But there was a crisis in Singapore last December. For two evenings in one week, there were delays in the underground trains. Now, my London house is on the Northern Line, so you can imagine that I didn't even notice this. This was a calamity. There was resignations. A public inquiry was set up, and there was a statement in the chief executive and the chair of SMRT had to resign. The organisation was fined $1 million for each episode of failure. And the minister made a statement in the house, and this is what he said. We too, both the Ministry of Transport as the supervising ministry and the Land Transport Authority as the regulator, have to shoulder our share of the responsibility. We all could have done more and should have done better. Well, I'll leave you in your baths this evening to think whether it's fanciful to imagine that in this country. So, to sum up, these are the lessons I've suggested at the primary prevention stage, but long-term planning, avoiding piecemeal change, the special risks of monopolies, the end-to-end process mapping allow you to ask the big ripple effect questions and not this obsession with detail, and the risk registers must be usable. The secondary prevention, when it's beginning to go wrong, and the idea, this difficult art of finding real risk of failure, of pointing your focus of the wrong way, escalation and traffic lights, about gossip and soft intelligence and the role of the board, and in tertiary, about the focused public statements, the deadlines must be realistic, put good people on the tasks, my criteria for whether or not to have an independent inquiry, and about language when attributing blame. Those are lessons that I've learnt from being the inside of a difficult set of episodes where really good people were trying to do their best and things that went wrong. And if I summed it up, learning from my new home, I would say we all could have done more and should have done better. Thank you very much.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.